This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned for today's program. And I am very pleased to have nationally renowned media critic Norman Solomon with us. Norman, thanks for being with us on the program.
Hi, Mike. My pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you on. We can talk about all things media. Since the last time we've had you on to really discuss issues in the media, there's been so many things that have happened. I mean, we have the whole issue of all of the mergers that's going on, and of course the whole issue of Pacifica and everything that's been happening there. I was just sort of going through this little rant. This morning I was driving into town and I was listening to some commercial FM radio stations, and they were just absolutely driving me nuts with this repetitive, inane programming of sort of, you know, sexual double entendres and a repetition of the same types of music over and over and over again. I mean, we really are living more and more in a homogenized media landscape, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely, where we have the same sort of messages, the same cookie-cutter audio and visual styles. And this is the result, I think, of a lot of corporatized concentration of economic power, and also some very specific measures. We can look back 4 years ago to the Telecommunications so-called Reform Act of 1996, which, among other things, allowed the same corporation to own up to 8 different radio stations in the same urban area in some of the larger cities. And then also the cumulative effect of FCC rules that said, hey, it doesn't matter whether you do local news or not. And when you stop and think about it, you know, if you've got a company like AM/FM or these other huge conglomerates that want to own and do own many, many hundreds of radio stations, something that they don't want to do is local news, right? So they're just feeding stuff off of their satellite, and a lot of times the radio stations are nothing more than a little concrete box that repeats what's coming off of the national airwaves.
That certainly seems to be coming more and more the case. You can sort of hear it if you listen, that you can hear that it's this automated process that's happening, and that any real connection to the given community is really non-existent.
Yeah, it's tenuous at best, and often just doesn't exist at all, as you say. But given that the mass media are not about civic service or making sense, but rather about making money, a lot of profits, this all is quite logical. It's the extension of the idea that making profit is the ultimate reason for being, and that any notion of public space is simply a fig leaf to cover the realities of ravaging corporate power. And so that's the result. And we're seeing now on cable television the just kind of extreme hype machine that is building corporatism into kind of a quasi-cultural commercialism that can't distinguish between creativity that exists to further human community and the so-called kind of ersatz creativity to commercialize every pixel and every square inch of space.
Talk, if you will, more about that, because that's a tremendously interesting concept.
Yeah, the culture of money is a powerful one. The incorporatization of the human impulse for community, for creativity, it's almost a forbidden topic in mass media. And when it's raised, when I'm able to raise it and other people do, I find it has a very strong reaction, both affirmative and very negative. I can give you a quick example that I happened to encounter. When the AOL Time Warner merger happened, it turned out that I had a few minutes to go on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer live to talk about my assessment of it. And without really planning to, in the course of my comments on the air, I referred to the mass corporatization of consciousness, and just kind of popped out of my mouth. And a number of people went out of their way to kind of find me an email or call to say that that analysis really struck very deep for them, as it certainly does for me. This corporatization of consciousness, this way that big money is able to dominate how we look at the world when we get up in the morning, and how people look at a forest as something that could be turned into money, and just this gauzy filter through which we begin to have a consciousness of what life even means is so increasingly corporatized. And many people find that repugnant, and yet it's so omnipresent and so powerful that we're dragged kicking and screaming into that vortex. So on the one hand, I think people, we are, so many of us, eager for a way to name this and challenge it. We have to identify it, analyze it, clearly name it, and fight against it creatively and assertively. But at the same time, my use of that phrase caused some very negative response. There was a columnist in the Philadelphia Inquirer, writes a business column there, who went out of his way to attack that very phrase because he thought it was ludicrous. And I think there you have it. We have, whether it's overt or not, kind of this polarization around what it means to be a human being in a corporate culture.
That's really very profound, because I remember talking with a professor, a sociology professor, an economics professor, who had written a book, The Corporatization of Culture, and you know that everything has become commodified. I mean, even down to almost our very thoughts, or at least the thoughts that there are, that the people who are presenting the information to us in many respects would like us to have.
Right. And this is something that has been in the works for, of course, a long time. And a lot of the power of corporatized media is to kind of poo-poo concerns and to mock this kind of a resistance to corporatization of our view of life. And, of course, this has been going on for a while. I think Herbert Marcuse, the great theorist back in the 1950s and 60s, was writing about this. Someone else who I think really saw this coming and raised the alarm in a very creative way was Herbert Schiller, who wrote a number of books, including one called Culture Incorporated. And Culture Incorporated was published in 1989. It was subtitled The Corporate Takeover of Public Expression. And Herb Schiller, who was a great guy, taught at UC San Diego in La Jolla. He died a few weeks after the merger of AOL Time Warner. And I went back and looked at his book, Culture Incorporated, and he really talked about the internalization of values among journalists and other professionals, and I suppose all of us, as being what he called the main lever of this process of corporatizing culture and corporatizing consciousness.
We're talking with Norman Solomon, media analyst, critic, and also author of the book, among many others, Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. Norman, a couple of things that I'm thinking about as you're speaking, and one is, I mean, we are talking about the public's airwaves, though that seems to have gotten lost. I mean, these stations have not bought the airwaves. They still tentatively belong to us, or at least allegedly, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, public space itself, I think, is a very important concept, because it's a vision or a model or an incarnation of how we feel we can live together as human beings and what community really means. And I think it runs parallel as a question to the matter of public forest. I mean, do trees exist to be chopped down for profit? Should there be protection of the ecology? Should there be parks inside cities that are safeguarded, or should they be encroached upon and built upon for private profit? And also even something as simple as a public library. I mean, if you go through communities, whether it's in Nevada City or San Francisco or New York, you will find a real change, I think, from, say, 20 or 30 years ago, when libraries were open longer, when they were more available, where they had more accessibility, just by terms of the hours that they were open and what they had to offer. And now, if you follow the logic of privatization, who needs libraries? Because you've got bookstores. And that's just one example of how the notion of public space has been really eroding through the years, and it's not an accident. And I'm afraid we're seeing this as well in terms of the Internet, where everybody should have free access to the Internet. I mean, not you shouldn't have to go to a library when it's open and maybe stand in line. It should be something very simple that you have an ISP that exists and is accessible because you want to get to it. And so what's been called the digital divide, but I think speaks to a profound class division of access to these technologies, that's a very key issue. And there's an enormous amount of profit being made with the erosion of public space as an ideal, as a concept that we fight for.
I know that Bob McChesney has also talked about this concept in regard to public space regarding media, and that there needs to be a space for public media where the profit motive does not dictate and dominate that which is covered and which is not covered, which really leads me to talk a little bit, if we can, about public radio and public television, because they seem to me increasingly, and you know, you just spoke about being on the NewsHour, and I've been listening to NPR lately, and it seems to be increasingly more dominated by commercial concerns. Can we talk about public TV and public radio, Norman?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's very important because while you do have glimmers of independent or progressive voices on public TV and radio, or all TV and radio for that matter, the proportions are increasingly dire. And so once in a while, progressives may get a few words in edgewise. But for instance, when I watch Channel 9, which is the big PBS affiliate in San Francisco, KQED television, often it seems as commercialized as avowedly commercial broadcasting like NBC or ABC, and perhaps even more insidious because the bar continues to be lowered, and even though it's called public broadcasting, you sit through a few minutes of these really pernicious and sometimes cloying, upper-crust-oriented, targeted commercials by any other name. Of course, I guess you know, Mike, that public broadcasting doesn't have commercials. It just has enhanced underwriter credits.
That's right. Yes, enhanced. I like that.
And they're getting longer and longer, I suppose, more and more enhanced as time goes on. And so what would have been very shocking and was a surprise to many people a few years ago of these longer and longer de facto commercials now has become normalized, and there are very high production values, very carefully shot, probably quite expensive for public television. A good example is the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, where you see these voluptuous shots of the waving fields of grain and whatever else it is for Archer Daniels Midland, the biggest agribusiness recipient of corporate welfare in the country, actually the biggest recipient of corporate welfare in the United States. And it just, you know, the myth is it doesn't affect programs, and yet, in fact, I think it clearly does, because it provides what the former Maverick FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson called the positive veto. And so when Archer Daniels Midland pumps several million dollars a year into the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, that helps to shape what the program is. And in fact, many programs exist only because a huge corporation has been willing to do that. I mean, an example would be, and I imagine this program airs in the Sacramento, Nevada City, Auburn areas, is Marketplace on Public Radio International.
Yes.
And it's only because General Electric took that program up and poured millions of dollars into it that the positive veto was able to make Marketplace happen. There is no national daily program on public radio called Labor Place. And the fact that we have this Marketplace program and no Labor Place program tells us a great deal.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We'll be back in just a minute. Talking with media analyst Norman Solomon. Norman, the effect that public radio and public television's increasing dependence has on major corporate underwriting. I mean, I think that that's a real issue in that it does affect programming, because if you only exist by the grace of the giving of a certain business, it becomes very difficult to do any stories that may be offensive to that business.
Yeah, I think that it works its way insidiously and kind of cumulatively. And a lot of things are simply understood. Nobody who works in a newsroom needs to get a fax or a memo from the board of directors saying that if you go after a huge conglomerate who happens to be helping to fund the program or the station or the network, that that's probably not a clear path to be pursuing, and it could cause some problems. I was speaking with Robert Perry, the very fine journalist who broke some of the initial Contra drug, Iran-Contra stories for AP in the 1980s and then reported for Newsweek for about 3 years. And Bob Perry described this phenomenon of self-censorship among journalists. He compared it to, say, a firefighter who is accustomed to going into buildings that are on fire, and they're is a ability after a quick while, actually, very quickly, to recognize certain rooms that are dangerous. And so, in effect, the firefighters may see that you don't want to go into a particular sorts of rooms in certain situations because they've seen what can happen if you do that. Some heavy stuff can fall on you quickly. So, in a sense, the understanding is don't go there. And mainstream journalists quickly gain that kind of understanding in the newsroom. There are many topics about corporate power, about how real estate and other interests manipulate the politics of an urban area. And journalists understand, don't go there, because if you do, it's going to cause you all kinds of problems. The messages are clear, and that's what self-censorship is about.
One of the questions that came to my mind, and perhaps I'm wrong, I don't think so, Kevin Close, who is the head of NPR now, correct?
Yeah.
He is also the former head of the Voice of America, correct?
Right. As a matter of fact, he was in charge of the U.S. broadcast agency overseen by the U.S. government that not only is in charge of Voice of America, but broadcasting of Radio Marti to Cuba and so forth, as a very clear arm of the U.S. government itself.
To what degree do you think the installment of Mr. Close at NPR has affected the programming?
Well, I think it's in sync with where NPR has been moving for a number of years, and so it both reflects and further reinforces this trend that says we're not here to watchdog the powers that be. Rather than that, we are actually part of the powers that be. And we want to be players. We are players. We're proud to be so. We're no more or less independent than the rest of the national Washington-based press corps. And that is, for them, the good news. I think for those of us who want independent journalism, it's very much the bad news. And it's both fidelity to the general outlooks of the government, which is definitely echoed, say, when the U.S. was bombing Yugoslavia or during the Gulf War, where I thought that NPR stood for National Pentagon Radio. And it's also reflected in kind of the routine genuflecting towards and references deference to corporate power. And so here we are, where every hour on the hour, NPR News has something called NPR Business Update. And just without a thought, top of the hour, a few minutes of news, then a couple minutes of the NPR Business Update, and perhaps needless to say, there's no hourly NPR labor update. There's no daily or even weekly NPR labor update, and that also speaks volumes.
We're talking with Norman Solomon, author of the book The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. Norman, part of what's happened at NPR hopefully allows me to segue to this issue in the fact that, as I understand it, NPR top management has come out against low-power FM, and despite the fact that FCC Chairman Kennard has apparently been in favor of low-power FM radio, there is now a fight in Congress and a and a movement being led by Representative Oxley, I believe, in an attempt to overthrow the FCC's decision and keep radio in the hands of the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio for the most part.
Yeah, National Public Radio has lined up with the National Association of Broadcasters and the Commercial Broadcasting Establishment, which is both literally and figuratively, I suppose, a symbol of where NPR is at. They see further diversification efforts by grassroots groups and organizations and individuals as a threat. I mean, the push from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and NPR has been to centralize through so-called public broadcasting. And so, you know, there's been this push to consolidate if you had different broadcast stations in the same area to kind of put the CPB money on the big ones and say, if you're too small, we don't want to give you funding. KBOO in Portland has had to fight this for years, as similar to KVMR, a really fine, solid grassroots community radio station, and CPB said, you know, you're not big enough, so we're not going to help you, which in a way is the opposite of how it should be. You know, CPB should be supporting smaller stations at the grassroots. And I think, as you point out, the decision of NPR to line up against microbroadcasting really exposes where they're coming from.
Well, I think the fact that the congressional push to attempt to overthrow the FCC's decision on this really talks a lot about where they're coming from and certainly where their money's coming from.
Yeah, it's really nauseating, and it really underscores the need for communities to support independent radio stations because, you know, whether it's KVMR or KPFA or whatever, you can't just take these community resources for granted. If you take them for granted, you're running a great risk that one day they will simply disappear.
We're speaking with media analyst Norman Solomon. Norman, you brought up the topic of KPFA, which leads me then to talk about what's happening with KPFA and with Pacifica in general. Can you let us know from your perspective what's been happening and what's the current state of affairs?
Well, we have the concern about the five Pacifica-owned stations in Berkeley, L.A., Houston, New York, and Washington, D.C. And then we have, a somewhat parallel concern about the National Pacifica programs, and in particular Pacifica Network News, which airs on 60 or 70 non-commercial radio stations. And both of those layers are directly affected by who, in a sense, owns Pacifica. I mean, it's a foundation, the Pacifica Foundation, which is nonprofit and all the rest of it, but the fact is that there's a board of directors that has legal ownership and control. And what has become crystal clear ever since early last year, and then with the lockout at KPFA last summer, is that the majority of the Pacifica Foundation board is no longer what we would call progressive. They added three new members a few weeks ago. Two out of the three were very strong corporatists. One comes from a law firm that brags that its services include helping companies to maintain union-free workplaces. The other is a former owner of the Denver Nuggets pro ball team that also specializes in buying and selling radio stations. So all in all, through lack of real governance accountability, even though we're used to thinking of Pacifica as a progressive institution, the reality is that most of the people on the board now are very corporatist, and they run the network. And that's reflected both in the horrendous and continually, I think, atrocious treatment of KPFA by National Pacifica, but also in the censorship that has taken hold at a number of stations, including KPFT in Houston, including WPFW in Washington, D.C., and to a significant extent, KPFK in Los Angeles, where bits of programs are snipped out if they refer to Pacifica in any critical way as a network, as a management entity. And meanwhile, we've got this very dire situation where Pacifica Network News has been censored for precisely that reason. And retaliation against Dan Coughlin, the producer there, who had the temerity to allow, 20-second 30-second report about a legitimate news story, a boycott that was carried out a number of months ago by many stations in protest of prior censorship at Pacifica. So I guess it's a long way of saying that I'm afraid at this point Pacifica Network News, as a nightly source of news and information, has had its integrity compromised. And that's a very sad situation, but it's reality, and many people are scrambling to create alternatives regionally and nationally to find and develop and strengthen other sources of news, which I think is really a crucial step that needs to be taken.
We've been speaking with Norman Solomon, national media analyst and critic, also author of the book, among many, The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. Norman, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I guess what I'd like to ask you is, what can the listeners do to try to impact the media landscape in a way that will make it more beneficial and positive, more of a service to the public? And then any other final thoughts that you'd like to share with us this afternoon?
Well, I think it's crucial that we challenge the mainstream media. We critique it, we analyze it, we organize to directly confront the local newspapers and television and radio outlets that have such a strong propaganda effect and impact. But also, meanwhile, that we sustain and support and strengthen independent media outlets, whether it's this radio station or independent publications and other ways that we can communicate with each other, work to use the Internet, to use the connection that the airwaves provide us for creative purposes and for sustaining and building community instead of just simply kowtowing at the altar of profit, which is clearly the dominant paradigm coming down from corporate media and corporate America. And that remains both our task and our opportunity because we want to create a future that is in line with our values, and that's going to involve a continuation of challenging the powers that be.
Norman Solomon, thank you for being with us on the program, and we look forward to having you on again.
Hey, thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. That's it for this edition of the program. Full Logic Reverse is produced at KVMR-FM Radio, Nevada City, California. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us at Full Logic Reverse in care of KVMR-FM Radio, 401 Spring Street, Nevada City, California, 95959. Or at 530-265-9073. I'm Mike Thornton, and we invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.